From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections Healthy Friday. The second open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act ended this past weekend. New York health officials say they're proud to have 2.1 million people signed up for health insurance on the state marketplace over these critical first 2 years. Health and Human Services reports 11.4 million enrollees to health insurance across the country. The Obama administration calls these numbers successes, but how close are they to their original projections? Later this hour, we'll talk about how Obamacare will affect your tax return, and it will. And if you'd like to ask us a question about that, give us a call with your insurance-related health questions at 1-844-895-TALK. 1-844-895-8255. Now, all of this is part of a reporting series, Understanding the Affordable Care Act. You find that online on our television news magazine, Need to Know, and right here on Healthy Friday. You can always learn more at our website, wxxi.org/ACA. Now, we're very fortunate to have some guests on the phone with us. Julie Appleby, she's a senior correspondent from Kaiser Health News, a great source of health news, especially when we're talking health policy and the Affordable Care Act. Thank you and welcome, Julie.
Thanks for having me on.
And also we have Kev Coleman. He's the head of research and data with Health Pocket. Thank you very much for being on today.
Absolutely, Michelle.
And in just a bit, when we get to our tax portion of the conversation, we'll have Debbie Zarnitsky here talking about taxes. So thank you very much for being on. We have some new numbers, some just fresh off the presses numbers. Julie, can you tell us what you learned in your presser this morning?
Well, there's a couple things going on. As you mentioned in your introduction, 11.4 million people have signed up for health insurance coverage through the federal health website, which serves 37 states, and New York does its own, as you mentioned. But this morning, the Health and Human Service officials said that they are going to create a special enrollment period for people who learn when they file their taxes that they owe a penalty for not having insurance coverage in 2014. So they're going to open up enrollment again in March 15th through April 30th for people who attest that, yeah, you know, I only realized this when I prepared my taxes. Yes, I paid the penalty fine for last year, but I really want to sign up for this year so that I don't pay a penalty for the full year this year. So they've opened up a special enrollment period for those folks who buy their own insurance but failed to do so so far.
Now, there has been some chatter online and even some comments on our website that this is somewhat undermining their original due dates and their deadlines. There was conversation about that last year when the deadline got pushed back and got pushed back. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, they created an open enrollment period because they want people to sign up during a certain section of the year. They want people to enroll. They don't want to just leave it open all the time because then they figure people would wait until they were sick or something else to enroll. So they wanted to create a special enrollment period. So that was one thing. They've extended it now because of this concern that many people, some polls have come out showing anywhere from one-third to maybe 40% of people who might face this penalty don't even realize there is a penalty for not having insurance. So they've opened up this special enrollment period to accommodate those folks. And a few other states have done this as well, and I think now that the federal government's website is having this special enrollment period, I think we'll see more states also open up enrollment again.
And in my reporting and talking earlier this week with Donna Frescator of the New York State of Health Marketplace, she's considering that as well. She hasn't absolutely committed to it, but I'm expecting that that'll probably be coming down the line today since the Fed's already made that decision.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a few more states. There's been a couple already that have said that they would do it, and Vermont, Minnesota, and I think we'll see New York and probably California and Kentucky moving fairly quickly, and then we'll probably hear a few other states as well.
Now, what are we looking at when we're talking about these projections? There are some articles that say that while the Obama administration is saying we're right on goal, we're on target, that maybe they've kind of changed some of their projections. What are you saying?
Well, originally, the Congressional Budget Office made an estimate that this year we'd see 13 million people enrolled through the exchanges, the various marketplaces in the states. Right now, they're saying 11.4 million people have at least started the process. Whether those folks pay a premium or not is the next question. The number is expected to fall perhaps to around 9 million. So we'll see by the end of the day how many people actually enroll and then pay their premiums. But 9 million versus 13 million, that's a lot of folks. The concern there is they want more people to enroll because they want a real good mix of both sort of healthy people and sick people to kind of cover all the costs. So the more people you can get to enroll, the more likely you have a lot of healthy people in there as well. So the fact that the numbers are below the original CBO estimates in some people's minds is a concern. Other folks say, well, these were just estimates, and look, we've got 11 million people. That's a lot. So there's some discussion, as you mentioned, about that.
And that spread is going to be a little bit different throughout the country. You know, that number is supposed to include people on state exchanges as well. I would imagine that the largest numbers of those people, and tell me if I'm wrong, the largest numbers of those people are going to be in states where they're putting a lot of effort into getting people enrolled.
You know, what's interesting is the state that has the largest enrollment this year is Florida, with 1.6 million people. And Florida's lawmakers have been opposed to a lot of the health care law. They haven't expanded Medicaid either in that state. But they have the largest enrollment. There was a lot of outreach focused in Florida by enrollment groups and consumer advocate type groups. They did get a lot of people enrolled, and they actually have more people enrolled now than California, which is, you know, roughly twice the size and population. So that's very interesting to see how that played out in the various states. Now, in New York, you've got 2.1 million people enrolled, and of those, about 1.5 million are in Medicaid, which is the program for folks who have lower incomes.
Yeah, two-thirds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a lot.
There's some conversation about that. I had asked this of Donna Frescatore. Why is it that we have so many people who are enrolling in Medicaid through this exchange at this point in time, and especially in this last open enrollment? Because you'd think that they would have gotten those people right away.
This is often a hard group to reach. So, you know, Medicaid's been around for a long time, and they've always had, you know, people who were eligible who didn't enroll. And now eligibility has been expanded to more people in most states. Some states like New York already had fairly generous enrollment, but many states have expanded eligibility, although about half have not. And so they're reaching out to this group that's maybe never had coverage before. It might be hard to track down and get them signed up. Yet we're seeing a lot of folks really jumping on this and signing up. In fact, I think they're estimating that almost 10 million people have enrolled in Medicaid since the inception a couple of years ago of the increased eligibility. And while some of those folks would have been eligible before under the old rules, the majority of them are newly eligible under the new federal health care rules.
Now, Kev Coleman, what is this meaning for cost and the spread of what people are actually paying for these marketplace plans?
Well, on the national level, we have seen premiums increase at a post-subsidy level to $105. The previous year, the average was $82, and these are based on preliminary numbers. As Julie mentioned earlier, we still have to see, you know, how many people this year actually effectuate their plans by paying their premiums, and then the averages will become superior, and we should know more in the spring. I think one of the biggest issues we have to consider about pricing is that this year, really, we still haven't seen the final pricing of the Affordable Care Act plans. And by that, I mean the premium rates that were determined for the 2015 year were still made with only a partial selection of data on healthcare usage by the 2014 enrollees. By the time we get into next year's enrollment period, the insurance companies will have much better data. One of the things that affects healthcare usage is deductibles, which at the lower level plans like Bronze, particularly popular for people who are off exchange, slows down the rate of healthcare usage traditionally at the beginning of the year. And then at the end of year, as the deductibles have paid, we typically will see some degree of acceleration of usage. So for myself as an analyst, I'm very interested to see what rates are going to look like next year. This year we're still kind of watching, waiting, and trying to understand the enrollee population, particularly given, once again, Julie's earlier comments, how many people actually stay enrolled. Last year we saw, 8 million people enrolled by April. By middle of August, that was down to about 6.7 million, so roughly a 16% drop. We still don't have a good understanding of who's leaving the risk pool and who's staying. Is there any trend demographically, health-wise, racially, et cetera? And I'm hoping that as time goes by, the government's going to make that data available.
Yeah, and actually, that's something that I wanted to ask you, both of you, but I'll start with Julie Appleby. We had this conversation before of the HHS actually just had a press release talking about how they're still not really getting as far with especially the Latino population and getting Latinos enrolled and underserved populations. What are they doing wrong? Is there any idea as to what's happening?
Again, it's a difficult population to enroll, is what the advocates say. I think there was a variety of things going on there. One thing, some Latino population folks were very concerned about enrolling because they weren't sure, would this lead to some other problems down the line? Would this be a problem? But there's been a lot of outreach. And I think Florida, if you look at Florida, there was a lot of outreach. I would be really interested to see what happens with the various breakdowns there. But generally, that's a very difficult population to enroll, but it's also the group that has the highest rate of uninsurance in the country. So it's really an important group to get. In a related note, I think Gallup has been tracking the uninsured rate in this country, and they said in the fourth quarter of 2014 that it's dropped to about 13% uninsured in the country, and that's the lowest since they began measuring it in 2008. While it's, improved across all the demographics, Gallup said that the sharpest decline in uninsured has been among African-American and low-income Americans. But while the number of uninsured Hispanics has decreased as well, they remain sort of the highest uninsured demographic, with about 32% not having coverage.
Any idea as to why that is, Kevin Coleman? And do you have any idea about, the demographic breakdown of people who are on different plans?
Great question. I think Julie admirably covered the issue with respect to some of the challenges that both the government as well as advocacy groups have found in trying to reach out to the Latino community and get them enrolled, particularly given the fact that there is this disproportionate representation of the uninsured within that population. There may be additional factors that could be coming into play here. The degree to which there are computers in the home and, easy internet access and, an abundance of, sites, that are Spanish-speaking that are promoting, the Affordable Care Act to this population. I do note that among the Hispanic population, there is a higher degree of reliance on phones for internet access, and we tend to search differently on phones. We use fewer words. We tend not to go to certain websites that aren't friendly for display on smartphones, et cetera. So I think we're still trying to understand this issue, particularly as we want to address the needs of the uninsured within the Latino community.
Now, Julie, when we talk about outreach, a lot of the what I've heard from HHS, what I've heard from people at the state health, they're saying that what's working for as far as outreach is having a lot of navigators, having a lot of investments in having in-person assisters, outreach in different communities, going to malls, talking to people in person. Not every state is doing that. Do we see that playing out in the numbers?
I think we still can't quite tell until we see all the state numbers and really kind of drill down, but certainly what the advocates say is that those in-person assistance programs, going to where people are really the way to get people to sign up, that people aren't necessarily just going to log on at home. They might do that later, but they want to come and talk with somebody. So, for example, if you can go to a local church or synagogue or mosque and catch people while they're there, you have an enrollment event. The outreach used a lot of new things like digital ads, and they're aiming at specific demographics and leverages what the government told us. In fact, they said that this year one-third of the media budget focused on Latinos, which was up from last year's, which was at about 10%. So they're really trying to figure out where are people, where can we reach them, where they're at, and how do we get them enrolled. So I think that's still a work in progress. But I think the fact that they've got more people enrolled, and in some states like Florida, they managed to sign up 90% of the subsidy-eligible people in Florida based on some recent research that came out. So that's a very interesting thing. It'll be very interesting to drill down in Florida and see how did they reach 90%. That's amazing.
Now, people are signed up on different plans that they call the different metal plans. That just basically means how expensive are they and what do they cover. They're all required to cover certain things. But so when it comes down to that, Kevin, where are we finding the breakup? Are most people signing up for the lowest cover plans, the bronze plans?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. We have a divide of the haves and the have-nots within America right now under the Affordable Care Act. When you take a look at people who are on exchange and typically accessing subsidies, you'll see that the silver plan is the most popular one. The second lowest cost silver plan in each region is the one upon which your subsidy level is determined, and it's a nice default choice. When you take a look at the off-exchange market and take a look at the research of one of the large online brokers, eHealth, their population is all gravitating towards the bronze plans, and those are the entry-level plans for the Affordable Care Act. So it's very interesting seeing the difference in consumer behavior, particularly as affected by the subsidies. Subsidies are massive. This year we talked about the average premium on the federal exchange being about $105. If you were to take that subsidy away, you're up to $374. That drastically changes how health insurance premium is going to affect your budget. So I think that this is going to continue to be an issue of debate and analysis, particularly given the fact that you have subsidies under review, as it were, by the public, by virtue of the fact that the Supreme Court is looking at the King versus Burwell case. So I think you're going to see a lot of continued discussion and debate on this subject in the media and the public for months to come.
Okay. I did want to ask you, too, how many people are going off exchange? Because it seems, that most of the efforts are to push people to go on the exchanges, but how many people are getting coverage off exchange?
That's a fantastic question. I have not been able to find information on that subject. And in the releases from Health and Human Services, they haven't shared that information. Part of that may be part of the technical challenges. You have a master data hub for healthcare.gov serving 37 states. You have the other states that are doing public reporting. There isn't currently some type of requirement to say, okay, let's also report all the off-exchange data in a timely fashion so we can have a better understanding of the individual health insurance market within the United States.
Now, Kev just mentioned King v. Burwell. Julie, what is that?
That's a court case that's going to the Supreme Court. There are going to be oral arguments early next month in this case, and it centers on the question of whether these subsidies that Kev was just talking about, whether they can be given out through the federal exchanges, which serve 37 states this year, or whether they can only be given out through state exchanges like the one in New York. At issue are four words in the statute, basically, that say that these subsidies should be given out through an exchange established by the state. So the question then is, does that include the states that are overseen by the federal website? So at issue is what will happen to those subsidies should the Supreme Court invalidate them in the federal marketplace, because then you would have 37 states, some 6+ million people who get a subsidy, perhaps seeing that subsidy end very quickly after the court ruling. And like they said, it's a substantial assistance with the premium for many of those folks.
And a lot of people are saying that this could be the end of Obamacare if, depending on the results of what happens in this case. Is that being too alarmist? And when I talk to people here in New York State, they say it'll have no effect on us because we're on a state exchange.
I don't think it'll be the end of Obamacare. I think that may be a little bit too much, but it would certainly affect very much the individual market, the place where people go buy their coverage in those 37 states. New York probably wouldn't be affected, at least not directly, because you could keep giving out the subsidies in New York and it wouldn't be affected directly. But what happens to the rest of the market in those other 37 states? And there's a lot of discussion about that right now. States could perhaps act to create their own exchanges to keep those subsidies flowing. Congress might act to keep the subsidies continuing through the end of the year while something else is worked out. That's, certainly not a uncertainty because Congress can't seem to agree on a lot of things right now. So whether that would happen or not, who knows? And many states have also said they might not take any action at all to keep the subsidies going. So it would be very interesting to see what happens. And it could be very problematic for people who buy their own coverage, because what happens if you suddenly don't have a lot of help paying your premium? You drop out. And if enough people drop out, insurers then have a much smaller risk pool. They're looking at their rates for 2016, and they're going to have to raise their rates. And some studies have shown that those rates might go up by half on average if, you know, 8 or 9 million people drop out of coverage because they no longer get a subsidy. The rates will go up a lot in 2016. So that's why this case is being watched very carefully. What's going to happen, we won't know probably until the end of June when the court rules, but it is a very difficult situation depending on how it turns out.
Now, Kev, she just gave some ideas of what some of the projections are on cost increases. Are you seeing about the same projections? Can you predict the future for us?
Okay, well, I'll give my first prediction of the future, which means, of course, we're held to account on this. Were the plaintiffs in King versus Burwell to prevail and subsidies were lost on the 37 states using the federal exchange, we would see a significant loss of enrollment for people who can no longer afford health insurance. The big question, though, is how would both the state and federal governments respond to this situation? And there are a plurality of options. And one of the things that's very interesting on the subject, and I was talking to a reporter in South Carolina recently on this subject, is that we also have to consider consumers who are unsubsidized. You know, when we're taking a look at the common weal and our aspirations to get everyone covered under health insurance, how would a moment like this affect our thinking and refinement of legislation to make sure that we get as many people covered as possible? And also think about the whole of the population. One of the things that's been very fascinating in the Affordable Care Act era, and perhaps one of the reasons why it's such a polarizing legislation among people, is the fact that you don't have a uniform distribution of benefits and costs across the population. You tend to have this asymmetry, so you kind of the haves and the have-nots, who gets subsidies, who doesn't. This has created kind of an interesting situation, and once again, if King versus Burwell all of a sudden creates chaos and we lose subsidies on healthcare.gov, it may invite perhaps more public comment and participation within the legislative responses to this issue. And for myself, I always believe in the American people and their participation and their contributions to the best thinking in America.
Well, thank you for that. Now, Julie, we're going to kind of turn gears, and in the next half of this hour, we're going to be talking only about taxes and how it affects the Affordable Care Act. But Julie, do you think, I think Kaiser Health had a story this week saying that a lot of people still don't know that they may owe some money on their taxes based on whether or not they got health insurance.
Right. A study came out from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Urban Institute that showed that 44% of uninsured people had heard little or nothing about the tax penalty. So people don't know that there might be this tax penalty for not having coverage. And then additionally, this is also a really complicated thing. Even those people who did know and who signed up and got a subsidy, now they've got to figure out, did they get the right amount of the subsidy? They've got to report this on their tax form. And again, remember, this is a very small minority of tax filers. Most people are just going to simply check a box saying, I had health insurance, because they got it through their job. The vast majority of people get health coverage through their job. But for those people who did purchase coverage and did get a subsidy last year, they have to fill out some additional forms, and they have to show what their income was. They have to show how much of a subsidy they had, and they have to reconcile that. Did they get the right amount? Did they get too little, and maybe the government owes them some more money? Or did they get too much of a subsidy, and maybe they have to pay some of it back? So this is going to be the next issue that we're going to be writing about and hearing about as people go to start filing their taxes this April.
Absolutely. If I may just add something to Julie's comments. That's one of the reasons why Health Pocket, subjectively opining on the subject, suggests that it would be good to move enrollment period towards tax season, because it's not just people who are facing the uninsured penalty, but also people that are in a situation where they find out, okay, you know, I have to give some of my subsidy back, or maybe I'm making more this year. How will that play on my subsidy eligibility? Given the dependencies between, you know, your income status and subsidization, it would make a lot of sense to move enrollment towards the tax season, so you know people can talk to their accountants and then allow that information to help them make the most informed health insurance choice.
Now we hope that
that's been brought up a lot, and the government has so far said that they haven't said anything about whether they're going to change the enrollment date for next year, but that has been the subject of discussion. And in fact, they were asked that this morning, when are we going to find out what the open enrollment period is for next year? And they said, well, not right now. We're not going to do it today, but maybe in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But it is possible that it could shift so that it coincides with tax season in the future and not just this special enrollment period.
Correct. And you would also have an additional benefit because people tend to forget that many of the insurance companies that offer Affordable Care Act compliant plans also offer Medicare plans. And what we have this past year and the year before is a overlap of enrollment periods. Well, just think about what call centers are like during that period. If you could separate those enrollment periods, that would just benefit consumers because, you know, then you're not dealing with the fact that, you know, Medicare annual enrollments for drug coverage, you know, your Part C and Part D, serves 37 million people, and you know, some of those are going to be clogging up phone lines when you need to, you know, talk about subsidies and medical plans, et cetera. So I think it would be a win-win situation if we could move the enrollment period to tax season.
Okay, well, we'll be talking about that a little bit more in the next part of the hour. Really want to thank our guests for this first part of the hour. Julie Appleby, senior correspondent from Kaiser Health News. Thanks for coming on the phone with us.
Thank you.
And Kev Coleman, head of research and data at Health Pocket. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. Good talking with you, Michelle.
Thank you. Now, we hope that we'll hear from all of our listeners. We know that you do have questions about your taxes, and you may never have had to think about how your health insurance was going to affect your taxes. We're talking about that for the rest of the hour. Give us a call, 1-844-295-TALK. You're listening to Connections Healthy Friday. And you're listening to Connections Healthy Friday. I'm Michelle Faust. Thanks for joining us. We hope you'll join us on the phone. We're here to answer your questions. If you have questions about how your health insurance will be affected by the Affordable Care Act and then your taxes, 1-844-295-TALK, 1-844-295-8255. Now, yes, this tax season, thank you very much. And in the studio with us, I mentioned her at the beginning of the hour, but I'm so sorry. Debbie Zarzitsky, CPA. She's the Director of Tax Quality Control at EFP Rottenberg. Thank you so much for being here. How is this tax season different than every other tax season that you've worked with?
I think every year there's something new that kind of throws us tax accountants for a loop. So this year is the Affordable Care Act. There's some new tax forms this year. There's not only some new tax forms to file with your tax return. As you talked earlier, if you purchased your insurance through the exchange or the marketplace, there's also a new form that you'll be receiving in the mail as part of your tax documents, Form 1095A. The new other new tax forms that we'll see as tax preparers and individuals filing the returns are the premium tax credit calculation, Form 8962, and the healthcare exemption or shared responsibility payment. Basically, our penalty, if you owe, is going to be calculated on the Form 8965.
So when people went and talked to their navigators or went on the exchange themselves, they sat there, they did some calculations, they put in some information. A lot of people in New York State, as we already mentioned, you know, 75% of those people who signed up in New York State are on Medicaid. So they're not going to necessarily need to worry about that as far as taxes are concerned. But the people who got the advanced tax credit, that's something you really need to think about. When you're signing up, you need to think about, what does that mean and what happens if my income changes over the year? Tell us about what does that mean? What is it that they're calculating? What are they looking at? And then do I take it ahead of time? Do I wait until I file my taxes?
All great questions. When Julie and Kev were talking, they kind of referred to it as a subsidy. So in our tax language, we kind of refer to it as advanced premium tax credit. Basically, when you sign up on the exchange, you have one of two options. They can kind of estimate what you think you might get in a tax credit, and you can apply that to offset your premiums. On the flip side, you can say, I'll just wait to file my tax return and I'll calculate the credit at that point and get it applied towards my tax liability, and it is refundable as well. If you do the advanced portion, then you have to reconcile it when it comes time to file your tax return. So you have to say, did I estimate correctly? And estimates are estimates. So there's probably gonna be some sort of reconciliation that takes place, and either you'll get an additional credit on your tax return, or you might have your income might have gone up, as you mentioned, and you actually owe some of that money back when you file your tax return. So there's a couple of different line items that are also new on the form this year.
You know, early in our project, as I've mentioned many times on this program, in our project Understanding the Affordable Care Act, one of the questions that we got that you'll find on our website, WXXI.org/ACA, was a question exactly about that. A person who is a sole proprietor and says from 1 year to the next, vast difference amount of income. And really, you know, how does a person in that situation guess? Do they just guess low and hope for the best?
Yeah, I would say that would be the case. You know, if they want to use part of that credit towards, you know, to offset their premium, then yeah, I would guess low as opposed to guessing high and having to owe some of that money back. They do set limits, though, too, as to how much repayment is required. So there might be a limit. It's all based on your filing status and income level, things of that nature as well.
Now, I'm imagining that you've talked to some clients that are in this situation. What are you seeing from your clients?
So far with our clients, as you mentioned earlier, and I think Julie mentioned, most of our clients are going to check a box that basically said they had full coverage for the year. They had coverage for every month. They had coverage for every person in their households, their spouse, their dependents. So far, we haven't seen too many people having to file these forms. I have come across a couple calculations so far, one being an individual that, you know, didn't have a very high-paying job last year and kind of weighed the odds of, do I get health care or do I just pay the penalty for the first year? So, you know, I did calculate the penalty, but the question with that penalty is going up every year. So I think I like the idea of that special enrollment period tied to the tax season, because, again, people that were unaware of this penalty or have no idea how much that penalty is going to be now will have that information and they'll think twice about going to get insurance.
Yeah. As of the moment that we came on air, it had not been announced that New York State was going to adopt this special enrollment period for people who haven't yet filed their taxes. But when I spoke to Donna Frescatore, who is the executive director of the New York State of Health Exchange, she explained that she was strongly considering it. And usually when the federal government makes a decision on their exchange, we tend to echo it here in New York State. So I would imagine that that's likely to happen.
Yeah, I would think that too.
So we have a caller on the line. Looks like Wiley has a question from Honeoy Falls about health insurance.
Hey there, Michelle. How you doing?
I'm well. Thanks and welcome.
Yes, how do you do? I didn't catch all your names, but I was listening to the topic today. And it was just something that I've been reading. There was a great article in Time magazine a few weeks ago about what I learned from my $190,000 open-heart surgery.
Yes.
By Stephen Brill.
Yes, yes. We've talked about that on this program.
Okay, well, I wouldn't be surprised. But first, what I want to say, because I'm thinking maybe a lot of the people listening to the show are old enough to remember, 53 years ago today, we were all glued to our TV sets watching this little cardboard space capsule going across this map of the world with wavy lines on that we couldn't figure out, watching John Glenn going around the world for the first time, first American to orbit the Earth, was 53 years ago today. Are you there?
How is this related to your health question?
It is. Okay. It's nothing. I just thought it'd be a little aside there.
Okay.
So what I really wanted to talk about was because of the health care, because of all the good little conservatives and Republicans and teabaggers want to overturn Obamacare, which is only trying to help people that don't have any have health care. And there's this great article that's what I'm trying to toot, and you can probably, you know about it, and your guests probably know about it too. It's just a matter of his idea was letting the fox run the hen house, which are the insurance companies running the hospitals, and turning that over to the people that are interested in making profits for these hospitals, but reining them in just enough so that they have to take care of the people that need the care rather than taking care of the people at the top who are making all the money. And the profit motive in this whole healthcare business that I found myself deeply involved with just because of my own health, and finding out that if you don't have any money but you can get Medicare, you're in pretty good shape, because Medicare, I don't know what I would be doing without it, and they cover all kinds of stuff.
So you've benefited from the expansion of Medicare.
Exactly. And it's but there's no reason why this couldn't be transferred instead of Medicare. Transferred, make the rein in these insurance companies and their profits. These guys couldn't spend, the guys at the top couldn't spend all the money they make in 10 of my lifetimes and 10 of my grandchildren's lifetimes, probably. And that's the problem, is the profits. Okay, the people that at the top deserve to make money, because if they can figure out how to do it, that's fine. But the people at the bottom suffer because of that, and it's the people that Obamacare is trying to help that are going to suffer from this when these goodwill Republicans get their way, because they know the only answers. And I think Democrats are just as bad in their own way, because they won't.
Lots of controversy around the topic. Thank you very much, Wiley, for your commentary on your thoughts about the Affordable Care Act. But a lot of people on both, he mentioned Republicans, but a lot of Democrats also who and people on the more left side who have made a lot of complaints about the Affordable Care Act and what was going on with that. If you have questions about taxes and the Affordable Care Act, give us a call, 1-844-295-TALK, 1-844-295-8255. So we talked a little bit about people who have a floating income, an income that changes if you're a sole proprietor. We talked a little bit about what's going to happen. What really are these penalties, and what do they look like for people? You know, there was some talk about them going up. There's a base penalty, but that's not what most people's penalty is.
Right. I think, and even as a tax preparer, the more you read into the law and read into the form instructions and how it works, I think we were all kind of blindsided a little bit by the penalty amount. I think the $95 amount has kind of floated out there for a year now, and that's what people think. Oh, if I don't have health insurance, I'll pay $95 penalty. In essence, that's not really the case. Basically, how they calculate the penalty, they have it's the greater of two calculations. Okay, the first being that flat rate, which is $95 per adult, but they look at the whole family as a whole. So if it's a husband and wife, there's $95 each, and it's another $47.50 per child. There is a cap, a maximum on that penalty for the family, of $285. Okay, so that's the one calculation at first. The second calculation is they look at your household income. Household includes everybody. Dependents' income, if you have a teenager that's working and has a job, their income kind of comes into that whole calculation. They look at 1% of your household income that's in excess of your filing threshold. So if you're a single person, it's around, I think, $10,150. So they look at your income over that times 1%. So they look at that amount versus the flat rate, and they take the greater of the two, and that's your penalty, in essence, for the year.
Now, this is something that you deal with every year. You're making these calculations. You're looking at these different numbers. But when a person is signing up for health care, back in November.
They're not thinking this, right?
These are not things that they're thinking. These are not calculations that they necessarily know. They haven't gotten there. I mean, is this going to have some major consequences for people? I mean, should people, instead of thinking, I'm going to end up paying $95, I'm going to end up paying $285 and just expect that and then be happy if the penalty is lower?
Right. That's the case. I think in this year, the surprises are, again, looking at that flat 95, which I think is the golden number versus it being higher. But I think more so it's going to push them to next year. It's going to think about, okay, what do I need to do for next year? Because that flat rate for next year is increasing to $325 per adult. Mm-hmm. Okay. Again, half of that for the children. And they're looking at 2% of your household income. So that's going to keep going up. And then for 2016, you probably have heard the numbers too, $695 per adult. So I think the fact that this is kind of the first year, the government's easing into the penalty this year. You know, it's not that substantial, but each year is going to get bigger and bigger.
But there are some other forms to fill out as well. If somebody, say, loses their job over the course of the year, if someone has some other major problem over the course of the year, mm-hmm. are they really going to have to pay that penalty?
All of it's going to vary. There's a huge calculation, and everything's done on a month-to-month basis. So whether somebody died, they have health care for 3 months out of the year, they get married, they have a kid, all those things come into play this year, and there's a calculation for it. So it gets more and more convoluted the more those things occur.
So I spoke to a few people, actually. I've been out in the community and I've spoken to a few people. You know, we're taking people's questions about the Affordable Care Act, and we hope that you'll call in or send us an email. Check us out on our website, wxxi.org/ACA. Come with your questions, because that helps us answer the questions of many people. But some people have said, what's going to happen? I got signed up. I paid my premium month one, month two, month three, month four. Something happened. I couldn't afford it.
Okay. They do give you, there's some different hardship exemptions that are in play. There's also they give you like a 3-month coverage lapse for an exemption, so you don't have to pay a penalty for those months. I've seen a couple things come across my desk just recently where some families had signed up in January, didn't have coverage in February, and then had it again March and April. So that middle month there for February, they were exempt for. So there's no penalty calculated for that month. So it gets a little more, again, convoluted. The calculation gets a little crazy, but there are some hardship exemptions for that. Another one is if you're not required to file a tax return because your income is below the filing threshold, there is no penalty to be calculated.
Are most of those people qualifying for Medicaid anyway?
I would think so, yeah.
Okay. The other thing is, when we talk about taxes, usually people who have the more complicated tax forms own a lot of different properties, businesses maybe. They're at a higher income bracket. Probably not qualifying for some of these advanced income, these tax credits. This is a population of people who don't necessarily have a lot of experience. People who are going to have to pay a penalty or not pay a penalty or pay taxes based on these tax credits, these are not people who had very complicated tax forms in the past.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Basically, anybody that's getting that premium tax credit, their income is within 100% to 400% of the poverty line levels. So they kind of identify those people. Again, they're filing their tax returns themselves. They're doing it online. They're doing TurboTax. Their tax returns are fairly simple. So this kind of throws a wrench into it when what if they don't have health insurance and have to calculate this penalty? I'm guessing a lot of those people are going to seek out some assistance this year.
Now, again, this is something I just came off the presses. So many new things about the Affordable Care Act. Just breaking news this morning. But one of my colleagues handed me an article from Vox about Health and Human Services. Looks like they may have sent out 800,000 of the enrollees that got their tax information in these forms. It looks like many of them got incorrect information, and about 50,000 of those people have already filed their taxes. What do they do?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I was talking to one of my coworkers before I came this morning, and they were trying to work their way through a calculation, and they felt that the 1095A that was issued was incorrect, just based on the information that was there and what they felt should have been reported. So it doesn't surprise me that that news came out today. I'm guessing, I mean, the government can issue corrected Form 1095As. If that's the case for people that have already filed and maybe their form was wrong and their calculation was wrong, they can file an amended return to get that corrected.
Now, not to say this is good news, but I would think people in your industry are going to have a lot more work to do this season.
We do every year, I think. And I think every year it seems like everybody's tax information comes in later and later, so it really condenses down our season. But yes, a lot of our clients have health insurance through their employers and such, and it's simply just check the box and you move on. But where we do have these calculations and trying to read and understand those new 1095A forms gets a little more difficult.
But I would imagine that some people who have always filed, like you said, most of the population that we're talking about that are going to necessarily maybe owe money, maybe not owe money, maybe getting some money back based on that advanced income tax credit, they're going to need more help. I mean, that's what we just said.
Yeah, definitely. I think they really need to, because it's not even something, the average person is going to have no idea how to calculate this. So even as tax preparers, it took us a little bit a time to understand the rules, apply the rules, and know that our system is calculating it correctly, in addition to the forms being right that they're getting from the government.
So saw some headlines just about a couple weeks ago about some problems with things like TurboTax, not necessarily calculating things exactly the way they were supposed to be, things getting hacked. Should people feel concerned about these things? What should people be doing?
Yeah, I think when there's anything new in the tax law and every year there's something different, there's always the concern that even the software is making the calculations correctly, things like TurboTax that so many people rely on and such. It's just how they program their programs. If it's garbage in, it's garbage out. If they're not doing it correctly, you know, they're going to affect a lot of people. So I would say always take caution, when it comes to, talking to a CPA or tax professional might be worth the extra effort this year, just to make sure that if they're getting a refund, it makes sense. If they are owing money, it makes sense, just to get a second set of eyes on those forms.
Do you think that a lot of people will be getting money back when it comes down to it? Because, I mean, if people chose to wait at the end of the year to get that subsidy, that money to help them pay for their taxes, are people going to be getting large rebates that they didn't have before, possibly?
It's hard to say at this point because, again, I haven't seen too many of those forms come across my desk yet. So I don't know if people took advantage of the subsidy and, have that kind of figured into their premium already, or if the majority of people said, I'll just wait and, would love the refund on my tax return. I'm almost guessing most people are going to use that money to apply towards the premium and use that subsidy. So I'm guessing the refund isn't going to be as large as people are expecting.
And that was some of the data that Kev Coleman had given us before, that a lot of people were taking the advance. But it's interesting to know. I mean, would you recommend that people do it at the end of the year, or maybe some people just can't afford to?
I think it's your personal tax situation. Again, some people, if by chance they don't need that money, then sure, just wait and get the credit later. But I would say in most cases, people are probably trying to at least guesstimate what they think that's going to be and just go ahead and use that towards their premiums.
Yeah. So very complicated tax season, especially because of the Affordable Care Act. Appreciate you taking the time with us today. We've been speaking with Debbie Zarzitsky, CPA, Director of Tax Quality Control at EFP Rottenberg. Affordable Care Act, so many questions about your taxes, questions about what your insurance will cover, what doctors are in your plan. We are answering all of those questions. Send us an email. Check us out. Check out our website first. Go to our website, wxxi.org/ACA. You can send us an email, acawxxi@wxxi.org. You can always check us out on Facebook and on Twitter. Use the hashtag on Twitter, #ACAWXXI. We're always coming up with more information about the Affordable Care Act, about innovations in healthcare, and we'll have more Healthy Friday coming up after a short break. In our headlines, we'll be talking about heroin abuse and addiction, a very large surge in the number of people who are dying from overdose with heroin. Very sad story, but we'll be talking about some possible Help, coming up in the next hour of Connections. I'm Michelle Faust. Thanks for joining us. This is Connections Healthy Friday from member-supported public radio.